Welcome back to the Arab Voices on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 FM in Galveston, and live broadcast on the internet at www.kpft.org. This is Saeed, producer and host of Arab Voices, along with my co-host Mark. With us now live over the phone from California is Professor Marjorie Kahn. Marjorie Kahn is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, a contributing editor to Truth Out, executive vice president of the National Lawyers Guild, and the U.S. representative to the Executive Committee of the American Association of Jurists. She lectures throughout the world on international human rights and U.S. foreign policy. She is a news consultant for CBS News and a legal analyst for Court TV. She also provides legal and political commentary on BBC, CNN, NPR, MSNBC, and Fox News. Professor Kahn co-authored the book Cameras in the Courtroom, Television and the Pursuit of Justice. She has published numerous articles in such journals as the National Law Journal, Christian Science Monitor, the Chicago Tribune. Professor Kahn writes monthly columns for the Los Angeles Daily Journal and the San Francisco Daily Journal, and she is a contributing editor to Jurist, TruthOut.org, and Guild Practitioner. Professor Kahn, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Saeed.
Thank you for joining us. We would like to get your, and if you can update us and our listeners, please, on the latest United Nations Security Council resolution that passed, supposedly giving more sovereignty to the Iraqis while the United States still occupies that country.
Yes, the new resolution says that the occupation will end and Iraq will reassert its full sovereignty by June the 30th. Yet U.S. commanders are still authorized to take all necessary measures to protect security and fight terrorism. And, of course, the U.S. will decide whether or not it's necessary to incarcerate, abuse, torture Iraqi prisoners to protect security and fight terrorism. And this is a real problem because the foreign troops will not be accountable to the Iraqis for their actions. So basically the resolution legitimizes U.S. military control over Iraq, yet it protects strategic U.S. interests.
So in what sense is this actually sovereignty? I'm kind of curious, because I always thought sovereignty was full control of everything in the country. And explain that, how this is passing for sovereignty.
Well, I agree. My feeling is that sovereignty is exclusive sovereignty. Sovereignty means you have control over your country. And there's some very nice rhetoric in the resolution about sovereignty and territorial integrity of Iraq. But the problem is that the multinational force, which is mostly U.S. troops, 138,000 U.S. troops, will remain under U.S. command. And although the resolution says that after a year, the Security Council will review this mandate for this multinational force, which is run by the U.S., or if the Iraq government of Iraq asks them to, and that it will expire by December 2005, assuming there's a constitutionally elected government. The problem is that the United States has a great deal of control over the government that's in Iraq right now. For example, the which has not been elected, Prime Minister Alawi, who was put in there at the behest of the United States, and really the UN Special Envoy Brahimi was really marginalized in the whole selection process of this new interim government. Alawi has close ties to the CIA, and in today's New York Times, it says that he ran an organization which sent agents into Baghdad in the early 1990s to plant bombs and sabotage government facilities under the direction of the CIA. Alawi also is responsible for that sensational claim that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction could be deployed in 45 minutes. And Alawi said he said that Iraqis don't want to continue to be under occupation, but then he pledged support for the continued presence of U.S. forces, quote, to help in defeating the enemies of Iraq, unquote. And it's not clear who the enemies of Iraq are. If they are outside forces such as Al-Qaeda, they certainly weren't present in Iraq before Bush invaded Iraq. And many people in Iraq see the occupiers as the enemy. So it's not really clear that Alawi has the support of the Iraqi people. And also, the other thing that's happened is that there was an interim constitution that was drafted several months ago, and it's not referred to at all in this resolution. And part of that constitution gave some rights to the Kurdish people. There's nothing protecting the Kurds in this resolution, and in fact, the Kurds are now threatening to secede. And so it's really kind of fanning the flames of dissension between groups in Iraq, and seems really to me to be more a question of window dressing to help Bush in the election in November by saying, well, we gave Iraq back its sovereignty in June. This June 30th deadline is a very artificial deadline, and the reason he has stuck to June 30th, even though Iraq has not been stabilized. In fact, there's more fighting in Iraq now than ever before, was because of the election and because Americans are tiring of their soldiers getting killed and billions of dollars of their tax money being spent in Iraq when there's no weapons of mass destruction, and they really don't understand why we're there.
Well, we're certainly going to have to watch the Kurdish thing closely, because Turkey has already promised to invade if there's an independent Kurdistan on its border.
Right.
So we have to keep an eye on that.
Why do you think that the U.S. Changed its mind regarding the Turkish involvement and participation in the Iraqi sovereignty? They seem to be backing them up earlier when the war started, and now what seems to be a surprise, they dropped their participation. Some say that this may have been to make Ayatollah Sistani to go along with this new UN Security Council resolution. Do you have any information on that?
No, but the U.S. resisted Turkey sending troops in I don't want to say during the war is still going on, but last year during the major hostilities, the U.S. doesn't want Turkey in there. And the U.S. is trying to play both ends against the middle with the Kurds, and is not doing a very good job of it. But the U.S. kind of has this, you know, this love-hate relationship with Turkey. They need Turkey, and Turkey refused to let them launch troops from Turkey, but yet they flew over their airspace. But the U.S. didn't take any reprisals against Turkey, because Turkey is one of the closest allies of the United States. So I think it's full of contradictions. But the U.S. doesn't want any interference with its own hegemony and influence in Iraq. You know, the other thing that's important to keep in mind is that, for example, the Washington Post came out today saying that the U.S. was giving in to France and Russia on this resolution, and how it really does turn over full sovereignty. And, you know, it just defies logic to assume that Bush is going to grant the Iraqis full sovereignty. I mean, he and the neoconservatives engaged in tremendous deception to get people to go along, to get the Congress, to get the American people to go along with this invasion. We've lost almost 1,000 U.S. soldiers, you know, to say nothing of the thousands and thousands of Iraqis who have been killed and wounded, and billions of dollars of U.S. money. I don't think that it was to get control of Iraqi oil, but rather to install in Iraq a U.S.-friendly regime which would protect our interests there, which means allow the U.S. to build what it is currently planning as the largest CIA station in the world in Baghdad, and locate several permanent bases in Iraq, U.S. military bases, to make sure that that area is so-called stabilized for U.S. Investment, and also to give U.S. corporate interests good deals on oil investment. So I think that it's more important to the U.S. to, which the U.S. has a history of doing, installing friendly kind of puppet regimes, which then make it easy for the U.S. government to protect foreign investment.
Of course, Saddam Hussein was an example of that.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And that pretty much puts the U.S. credibility on the line, especially as they talk and as the president talked even today at the G8 summit about the reform in the bigger Middle East, or his vision or his plans for the reform in the world, while people there see what the U.S. is doing on the ground is one thing, and what they are breaching really is a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, and when he talks about reform, I mean, he talks about democracy, he talks about reform, he's not really interested in democracy. He's interested in stability, because investment thrives on stability. And the United States has a history of actually the CIA overthrowing democratically elected governments and installing dictators who are friendly to U.S. corporate interests. It happened in Chile, it happened in Iran, and it just happened in Haiti as well. Unfortunately, the news about Haiti has all but disappeared from the radar screen. But that was a democratically elected president. He was elected with 80% of the vote, and he was being squeezed by the U.S., who was insisting on privatization and globalization, and he had tremendous debt, and there were problems. And all governments have problems, democratic and otherwise, and when you have problems, you don't engage in a military coup. But it was really to create so-called stability for the U.S. government, and they threatened him. They put him on a plane. They held him incommunicado. They said they couldn't protect him, and an hour later, the Marines showed up and maintained order, and then installed a government which is very unpopular, and the other Caribbean countries are refused to recognize it. So this is nothing new. So when Bush talks about a plan for the Middle East and bringing democracy, he's really talking about making the Middle East safe for foreign investment.
And you're listening to the Arab Voices on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, producer and host of the show. Our guest tonight is Professor Marjorie Cohn, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. We are discussing with her the situation in Iraq. And I want to remind you of our phone number. It's 713-526-5738. So if you have any comment or questions for our guest, please give us a call at 713-526-KPFT. Professor Cohn, let me ask you about the Iraqi street, the Iraqi people there. Do you have any sense of what they feel, or what is their reaction to the latest UN Security Council resolution?
Well, in today's New York Times on the web, it looks like there are more attacks on U.S. forces and their allies than ever before. Not than ever before, but than in the recent period. Several fronts. They seized a police station in Najaf. There was an attack on the American forces in Fallujah. There were attacks on oil pipelines in Kirkuk. So it looks like if this new resolution has not had any reassuring effect at all on the Iraqi people. I mean, it certainly hasn't made things more stable or less violent. On the contrary.
Now, of course, President Bush has said a couple of times, as well as some other people in the administration, that this is a sign of the success of policy, and a sign of the increasing desperation of what they keep calling insurgents. What's your comment on that?
Well, I mean, what if Iraq or some foreign country came into the United States and occupied the United States. And there were soldiers on, foreign soldiers on every street corner. And anyone who went out after curfew was killed. And the electricity was not functioning, and people, thousands of people lost their jobs. We would probably take up arms to kick out the invaders, the occupiers. And so these are the Iraqi people who are fighting to expel what they see as foreign invaders from their country. These are not so-called insurgents, and the media has a great way of spinning, and of course this comes from the government, and then the media picks it up.
Yeah, they just use the exact same terminology.
Right, exactly. The insurgents. This is not just a small insurgency. It's going on all over Iraq, where people are taking up arms, whatever arms they can find, against the certainly militarily superior United States, to protect their country against what they see as the occupying forces. And it's interesting that there was a lot of speculation. There's been a traditional conflict between the Shia and the Sunni, and yet when the occupiers invaded, they banded together to expel them. The Kurds are another story. That's very complicated. But now, I mean, they have not appeared to be too upset until now, when this so-called sovereignty is being given to Iraq, and they've been totally cut out of the deal. They're now upset about it. So it's very complicated, and it's not clear what would happen if the Iraqis were left to their own devices. But that's what has to happen. That's the only thing that realistically, and well, not just realistically, but it's only right that the Iraqis, however they decide to run their country, they run it without foreign interference. The regime change in the first place was illegal. It violates international law. No country has the right to change the regime of another country. It was not done with the blessing of the Security Council. It was not done in self-defense. It was illegal. And the United States really ought to pull out of there, and the UN take over and help the Iraqis transition back to running their country.
Okay, let's take some phone calls from our listeners. I want to remind you again of the phone number. It's 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. Let's go next to our first caller, Mike. Mike, you're on there.
Yes, good evening. Good evening, Dr. Khan.
Good evening,
Saeed. How y'all doing?
Good evening. Hi.
I got two quick questions and a comment. The first comment is, I think after June the 30th, we're still going to continue to see more U.S. troops killed, and I predict before too long we're going to see 2,000 U.S. troops dead easily. My first question is, would you agree that there was a bigger justification of going into Normandy, France in 1944 versus going to Iraq in 2001 like the media is trying to play up? That's my first question.
Yes, absolutely.
Speak up a little bit.
Yes. The answer is yes.
Because I was talking to a couple of World War II vets recently, and they told me that they see no correlation between what happened at Normandy in 1944 and Iraq. They said there's two different animals.
You're right, and the whole media spectacle of D-Day and Bush using it for political gain, as if talking about Iraq as if it's on par with World War II is just pure propaganda. There's no comparison at all.
I agree. And my second question, ma'am, is would you agree that President Reagan would probably not handle Iraq the same way that Bush too has handled it? Do you think he would have done the same thing?
You know, President Reagan was a very popular president, and he was different from Bush in a number of ways, one of which that he had a very good delivery. He was an actor, and he was able to convince people of many things that he was very articulate. But he also went into, he was supporting the Iran-Contra affair, which was illegal, which actually could have gotten him impeached had he been directly implicated, and he really was eventually implicated, but since he was so popular, he didn't. There were no ramifications from that. He went into Grenada. But, you know, he did not have the neoconservatives behind him. I mean, he was a conservative, and he, you know, has a real mixed record both on foreign policy and domestically, in my opinion. But he didn't have the neoconservatives behind him, the Wolfowitzes and the Pearls and the Frums, who were pushing Bush to invade a sovereign country for no reason other than they wanted to take it over.
Correct.
And okay. It's very hard to say since Reagan lived in a different time, but I doubt it. I don't think so.
All right. Thank you, Mike, for your call.
Well, God bless you and have a good night.
Thanks, Mike.
And I am also have the concern that Mike does about, 2,000 or more U.S. soldiers being killed in Iraq and thousands of Iraqis continue to be killed. I think that's a real concern. It just breaks my heart when I hear about any of these people being killed. They shouldn't even be over there. It's absolutely outrageous. And, you know, 11 million people around the world knew that and marched in the streets before this happened and said, no, Iraq is not a threat to anybody, and it shouldn't happen. And it's just getting worse. And I don't see it getting any better. I hate to sound pessimistic.
You know, it's interesting. You referred to Reagan as being a very popular president, and I always I'm kind of taken aback by that. I witnessed that election from the other side of the pond, and I remember that the so-called landslide that Reagan got was 26%. Which didn't seem to me like a huge number, but it's strange how we project backwards, I guess. And there is this image now that Reagan was a very popular president, even though he didn't get a big chunk of votes when he was voted in. But anyway, that's a historical aside. You mentioned at the beginning, you used a word that I'm very interested in. You said mandate, and that the UN would re-examine the Iraqi situation and see if there was a mandate to continue it for longer. And I'm going to have to go back through my history books and see how this resolution's language compares with the other resolutions that gave the British and the French mandates in the Middle East. It's going to be something I'm going to have to examine. Do you have any comment on the idea of mandate before we take our next caller?
Well, in the resolution, it talks about a mandate. It says a mandate for the multinational force shall be reviewed, and the mandate, it will terminate this mandate. Mandate shall expire by December, basically the end of the political process, which is, if you look back at another section, it's December 2005. It doesn't actually give a date. It says once the political process is finished, and of course I can see the U.S. arguing in a year and a half that the political process still isn't complete, and so there's no expiration of the mandate. But it does talk about a mandate in here.
Well, it's very interesting that we often refer to Mandate Palestine as the area, the territory that the British ruled over during that period. And I wonder if decades from now people are going to be talking about Mandate Iraq. If Iraq is going to change, we'll have to watch that, of course.
Okay, let's take more callers from our listeners. That number again is 713-526-5738. And we're talking with Marjorie Coyne, professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Obviously, we're discussing the situation in Iraq. Our next caller is Barry. Barry, you're on the air.
Yes, I find your guest articulate and heard, and she knows a lot. But I think the lady protested a bit too much in reaching to make America the bad guy. I'm not hearing her mention anything about there were villages in Iraq that didn't have clean water, didn't have electricity, didn't have any of the modern amenities we have now. I don't think it's actually too much to say a thank you for that. America doesn't get anything good in her eyes. And how does she know for a fact what the CIA is doing? Does she have access to the classified records? Does she have lunch with the CIA breakfast? I mean, I find this lady to be a little more than a puppet of the bleeding heart liberal left.
Okay, well, let's see what Professor Cohen has to say about that. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, Barry, I think that after the fall of Saddam Hussein, there were many people in Iraq who were saying, you know, we're so glad that Saddam is no longer ruling our country and things are going to get better. And my reading, and I read 5 newspapers every day, and I'm not sure if they're the right newspapers, but I do a lot of research, is that most Iraqis have changed their minds, and there is not electricity. in many parts of Iraq when there was before. There's not running water where there was before. Many of the people who had jobs under Saddam Hussein have lost their jobs, many thousands of people, and I was no fan of Saddam Hussein's. And in terms of the CIA, it was the front page of the New York Times this morning that actually talked about new Prime Minister Alawi's ties with the CIA and how he sent agents into Baghdad to plant bombs and sabotage government facilities under the direction of the CIA.
And his group was also behind that failed coup attempt in 91.
Right. And also, it has been conclusively proved, and I don't think there's any dispute at all about this, that the CIA overthrew, and I believe it was 1953, overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran and installed and helped install the Shah of Iran, who was a vicious dictator who ruled Iran for 25 years, torturing and murdering people, many, many, many thousands of people. And the same in Chile. Salvador Allende was a democratically elected president. And it is now undisputed, and I think you can look this up in anywhere you want, and you will find that the CIA did overthrow that democratically elected government and install, again, one of the most ruthless dictators ever known to the world, and that was Augusto Pinochet.
And that was September 11th as well, which is...
September 11th, 1973, I believe.
I think it was, yes.
So this is, you know, if you do some research, I think you're going to find that these are the facts.
Also, I want to mention to our caller, Barry, we've had on the show here on Arab Voices, I want to say about 3 months ago or so, Rahul Mahajan, who is an anti-war activist, he had just came back from Iraq. He was in Iraq. He came back, and I put him live on the show. And he's a well-known peace activist. And he talked of tremendous amount of destruction in Iraq. And he talked about the hospitals and the water and all the stuff that you mentioned. And he said that all of that stuff was available, was in Iraq before the war. It is not there now, and it's not going to be there anytime soon. So we had eyewitness. We had Adam Shapiro, who went to Iraq, and he also talked live on the air of things that are completely much, much worse now in terms of the daily life of the Iraqi people and so on. We may play some of them again on the show, or have more people also talking about these topics in future
Saeed,
shows.
May I add something as well?
Sure.
Another thing that, of course, many Iraqis were very distressed about was the torture that took place under the rule of Saddam Hussein. And yet many of those same Iraqis are saying, are very, very upset about the torture that's happening on the part of some U.S. military forces and mercenaries in Abu Ghraib and other prisons around Iraq. And Abu Ghraib, of course, was one of the most notorious prisons under Saddam Hussein, and yet there's torture happening there now under the American regime. And so it's not to say that Saddam Hussein was such a great guy, but when you have Iraqis whose families, whose relatives were killed and tortured by Saddam, and there have been reports of many of these people in the newspapers that I've read who say, you know, it's worse now than it was under Saddam Hussein, that's very disturbing.
Yes. Let's go next to Tabitha. Tabitha, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering if you might be able to expand a bit on the situation with the Kurds. You mentioned it briefly, and I just became curious because we never hear about them on the media. I never heard a word. So I was just wondering if you might be able to explain what the political situation is with the Kurdish people.
Well, there are two main leaders, two Kurdish leaders, and they wrote a letter to President Bush this week, and they said that the Kurds were not going to participate in the central government in Baghdad if there was any attempt made to nullify that interim constitution, which provided for some political participation and protection of the Kurds. And because there was some objection from the Shiite leaders, they to the protection of the Kurds in the constitution, The U.S. agreed, went along with the taking the Kurds completely out of this and not providing them any protection at all. There's also talk of something which is tantamount to secession, that the Kurds would actually like to secede and completely separate from Iraq and become their own greater Kurdistan. And that's, of course, you know, there are many Kurds in Turkey, and Turkey would be very, very upset if that happened, and might likely come into Iraq to prevent that from happening, which would create...
They've already said they would invade if an independent Kurdistan is established on their border. So
right.
I'm wondering if the Kurdish position has been marginalized as a result of the U.S. not being able to inject troops through Turkey, because I'm pretty sure that the northern front in Iraq was going to be through, I mean, it has to be since it's the north, through the Kurdish areas, and the Kurds were going to be used as proxy fighters to some extent and going to be supplied by U.S. troops coming from Turkey. And I think since that didn't happen and the U.S. came in from the other side of the country, that I'm pretty sure that was the beginning of the marginalization of the Kurdish political process. And they've kind of been dropped off the news since then. So I'm wondering if Turkey inadvertently played a card which will lead to some kind of Kurdish national state. We'll have to see.
I think you may be right about that, but remember the majority of people in Turkey were very much against allowing the U.S. troops to do that, and
it was 90...
their own political changes, and so there were a lot of forces at work and made it very difficult.
No, the Turkish government was very much in favor, but the Turkish people absolutely rejected it, and
right.
You know, unlike here and in England, the government had to listen to its people.
Right.
All right, that number again for our listeners is 713-526-5738. And let's take a call now from Joseph. Joseph, you're on there.
Hi, thank you. Yes, I have a question. Well, I guess it's a question, but I'd like to express some of the debate that I have had with many Americans and people that don't really watch the news as much as I do. In America, there's a big desensitizing of people really realizing what seems to be going on. I don't know why it is, but that's just the fact. But I've had many debates with other people who don't quite see things as cynically, perhaps, as I do. And that is, if I can try to express it, you know, I've had talks where I have debated where if we'd have gone in to Iraq with France and Germany and the rest of the world, my feeling is that the Iraqis would not have fought back so violently. They would have felt like, oh, well, you know, if the rest is the whole us against the whole world. But the fact that it was unilaterally just the United States on this preemptive strike, it's a whole lot different than the way this liberating kind of idea that they try to express in the media. And I don't know if that would have been possible because the rest of the world, you know, perhaps they saw through the United States, but there's this big charade going on with our media that I don't know. And referring to what you're saying as far as how it's all just a big lie, you know, I just want to hear some of your comments about that.
Well, Joseph, I think you raise a very interesting point about desensitizing, because, you know, when the invasion first happened, you saw stations such as CNN saying, "Oh, look, it's like fireworks over Baghdad," and you saw these lights go off, and it looked like a fireworks show. And meanwhile, on the Arab TV stations, they were seeing dead and wounded Iraqi women and children.
Gosh, yeah.
And so they got a very different picture than we do. The other thing is that the Bush administration has forbidden any photographing of the coffins of the U.S. soldiers coming back. And I think that the reason they do that is because during Vietnam, when body bags and coffins of U.S. soldiers came back and they were shown on television, the American people got very upset. And justifiably so. And so we have the media, at the behest of the government, really shielding us from the reality of what's happening in that country, and that is the death and devastation of both the Iraqi people and the American troops. and but yet most Americans are becoming very upset with this war, even though they're not seeing it. They're hearing when Ted Koppel read all the names of the soldiers. You know, the government had a fit, but yet people heard that. And a couple of weeks ago, in the Sunday comic strip Doonesbury, I think it was on, might have been on Memorial Day, I think it was Doonesbury. The whole Doonesbury column, comic strip, was names of all of the Americans that have been killed. And I think that it's getting out. People are seeing that our troops are dying and being wounded, and that the economy is going down the tubes. And so people, in spite of the media, which of course is controlled by the big corporations for the most part, so it's not unusual that they would be doing the bidding of the government. But
I thought it was the left wing. I thought it was the left wing media. What happened to that?
You know, yeah, the left wing media. I don't. This right wing, left wing. You know, it's not useful. It's really not. And I think that that American people are going to get increasingly tired of this war, and hopefully that will be reflected in November in the election.
Okay, can you give us in about 30 seconds or 40 seconds your last thoughts on what's going on?
Yes, I think that people need to look at this situation critically, and if people really think that we should not be there and we shouldn't be losing any more troops and we shouldn't be spending more money, it's very, very important to let your congresspeople know about that and write letters and call them, because Congress, they are political, they do respond to pressure, and that's very, very important. And the other thing is to really pay close attention. It's very important that people vote in November. People's votes do count, and if people don't agree with Bush's policies, even if Kerry is not the perfect alternative, he is not Bush, and Bush is certainly has certainly been responsible for a great deal of death and devastation. So I think that it's important for people to vote. It's important for people to demonstrate, write letters, and call your congressman, and make your views known.
All right, that was Professor Marjorie Cohen. She's a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. Thank you so much, Dr. Cohen, for spending the time with us this evening.
My pleasure, Saeed.
Thank you.
Hopefully we'll have you back at some point, when maybe after June, and we'll see what happens with the Constitution and the sovereignty, so-called.
My pleasure.
And we're nearing the top of the hour. That pretty much wraps it up for the show tonight. You've been listening to the Arab Voices on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. Many thanks to my co-host Mark and the volunteers Matthew and Ayman. This is Saeed, producer and host of the show. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.